This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That's when we check in with reporters in Northwest Indiana media to check on the stories that they have put out in print and online. And we have with us first today Dan Carden, who's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Dan, thank you for joining us on the program.
Happy to be here.
Well, first off, of a number of stories that you've had put out in print and online is one that kind of reminds us that the coronavirus pandemic doesn't seem to affect the courts all that much. And certainly there's been a lot of other activity in the years before the pandemic that have made the need for a new Lake County magistrate possible. And tell us more about what lawmakers have done concerning that request.
Yeah, this is something that has been pending at the General Assembly for a while now. It's kind of a drawn-out process to approve a new judge or magistrate in a county because they are paid by the state. So the state wants to make sure there's actually a genuine need before it, you know, puts out, you know, a six-figure salary for this position. But in Lake County, the county officials, various judges, managed to persuade the General Assembly that a magistrate is needed in Lake Superior Court 4, which is based in Hammond. That court has had a huge increase in its caseload because Hammond and Whiting closed their city courts. So now all those cases are being handled by the county. And this court has never had a magistrate to assist the judge to hear cases. So they'd be both able to, you know, do judicial stuff at the same time. And the General Assembly agreed that there is a need for it. And just a few days ago, they approved legislation that includes creating this magistrate position. So this should be filled. Once the measure is signed into law, it should be filled in due course.
Now, I wonder how long, once it is signed into law, it's going to take to be able to get that new magistrate established.
Yeah, I believe the law takes effect July 1st, So it'll be right around there when the appointment can be made.
Oh, I see. So it won't be very long after the official go-ahead, so to speak, comes from the governor on that. So that's interesting.
Correct.
One of the other stories that you had, it follows along with Lake County government. We've had lots, and in fact, on one of our last conversations with you about this, we know that there's an issue that's gone to court involving who does the purchasing and the data processing authorities in Lake County. And the lawmakers did manage to change the law back that got mishandled a few times in the past, I guess, in particular, that it had taken away the ability for the authorities to happen. That's been changed in state law, but it's going to still end up in court. And it looks like now, based on your story that's come out, it's a kind of a question between the attorneys that are hired by the county to handle all this. And bring us up to date with the latest court hearing on that.
Yeah. So this has been an issue for the past few months. The Lake County Council is trying to take control of county government purchasing and data processing from the Lake County Commissioners. So it's the legislative branch trying to take over something that's been done by the executive branch. The Lake County Council claims that a 1981 Indiana law gives them the power to do that. The commissioners point to other parts of Indiana law that say only they have the power to negotiate contracts. So how are you going to be in charge of purchasing if you can't negotiate a contract?
Yeah.
And now this is all pending in front of a judge. What started it on the road to court was, as you mentioned, there was this sort of weird thing that happened. The process for Lake County to pass an ordinance, for the Lake County Council to pass an ordinance, for the Lake County Commissioners to veto it, for the Lake County Council to enact it anyway, was accidentally deleted by the General Assembly in 2019. So there was a law enacted this year that's already been signed by the governor to put that all back. Retroactive to 2019, so it's like there was no problem. But now, you know, the question of who can do what is still pending in front of Judge Cedia, and he said he was planning to rule in a short little while over how that's going to go. And I would assume that ends up getting appealed to the Court of Appeals and probably the Supreme Court as well. So this is sort of the beginning of a a drawn-out process here.
Well, we kind of figured this is the way it was going to happen, regardless of whether the original problem involved with taking the authority out of the law had been resolved or not. It's been resolved, as you mentioned here, because of the new bill that got passed and signed by the governor, but it's still going to end up in the courts anyway. We'll just have to, I guess, wait and see about that.
Well, and this all plays into the county sheriff, too.
This
all sort of stems from the county council funding a bunch of stuff that the sheriff says he needs to preserve public safety in Lake County, and the county commissioner saying that they don't think the sheriff needs everything that he wants. And so that's kind of what spurred the council to start moving in this direction. So there's that angle of it as well, this whole, you know, what does the sheriff need in order to effectively preserve public safety? Does he need a new boat on Lake Michigan? Does he need jet skis and ATVs?
The council says
he does. The commissioner says he doesn't.
One of the other stories that you had out there in the Times online as well as in print brings back the former Lake County recorder, Michael B. Brown. And now his legal problems outside of the issues that that kind of got him in trouble here in Lake County, he's now in trouble in another state. And I understand he's having a lot of problems trying to get an attorney, which you would think would not be a problem to find an attorney to defend him in court.
Yeah, part of the issue is he is charged with drug dealing in Wisconsin. This is in like middle of nowhere, northern Wisconsin, like north of Green Bay. So
yeah.
after Mike Brown ended his term as Lake County recorder, he moved to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, but the far western end. So he's over Wisconsin, sort of almost all the way towards Minnesota. So he was in this case, according to court records, moving stuff from his home in Indiana to his new home in Michigan when he got pulled over in Wisconsin for not having, he had a headlight out. When the police searched his car, they found about 10 grams of marijuana in a glass ball jar that was just in the front seat, according to the court records. So he is accused in Wisconsin of drug dealing, not just drug possession. And he's got this court case pending. And, you know, like I was saying, there's just not a lot of lawyers up there. It's a small county, Forest County, Wisconsin. Mike Brown said he reached out to attorneys in Appleton and Green Bay, and they were either non-responsive or too expensive. So he thinks he has an attorney now in this Forest County, and he's going to there's going to be another court hearing in a couple of weeks. And, we'll just keep tabs on it as it moves through the legal system.
Yeah. No, it sounds like, well, we know for sure that this will keep the media in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, that area up there, which is probably about not far from where he got stopped to begin with. We'll keep them busy trying to figure out what Michael B. Brown's doing from Indiana all the way up there. So.
Yeah.
One of the other stories that you had out there as well talks about the change in casinos. In this case, it's about the opening of the new Hard Rock Casino in Gary, and now I guess the permanent closing soon of the Majestic Star Casino Boats. Tell us about that.
Yeah, on Sunday, it's sort of the end of an era. The Majestic Star Casinos at Buffington Harbor on Lake Michigan. They've been operating there for 25 years, back in the day when they had to sail on Lake Michigan every hour, they are going to be permanently closing Sunday at midnight. It's because the law that allowed the casino to move on land or to relocate on land in Gary also required all the current employees at the Majestic Star to be provided jobs at the new Hard Rock Casino. So you can't just sort of close one and open the other at the same time. You need to move the employees, train the employees. It is a different kind of, it's the same sort of, same company more or less in charge that owns the casino, but Hard Rock is going to be the operator of the casino instead of Spectacle Entertainment. So it's, they need to train them on everything that Hard Rock wants its employees doing and sort of the Hard Rock mentality of interacting with guests and that type of experience. So they're going to take a few weeks before the new Hard Rock Casino opens May 14th and, retrain the employees, get them situated in the new place. And then they also need to bring over some of the gaming equipment. A lot of the stuff in the Hard Rock is going to be brand new. It's going to be, you know, all the latest games, but they are bringing some things over from Majestic Star to Hard Rock, so that takes some time to do the transition as well.
I know that's in your story as well, too, is about the disposal, or I guess what would be the disposal of the old Majestic Star Hotel. That's been closed for some time, and we know that there are still plans, although they haven't been started yet, to bring a hotel to the new Hard Rock Casino there on Burr and I-80-94. But still, that's still going to leave some buildings standing up there. Is there any word as to what's going to happen, first off, to the old hotel that was there at the casinos that are going to be closed up as of this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, that's just sort of sitting there right now. It closed. Oh, man, almost 2 years ago, I think, when Spectacle ended up buying Majestic Star from this, you know, Minnesota investment fund that kind of got it and ran it for a few years after Don Barden died. But that's sort of sitting there. All of Buffington Harbor is really kind of a mystery right now. There is money. There's $1.5 million that's going to be in the Indiana state budget, federal funds from the American Rescue Plan to study how Buffington Harbor can be redeveloped. There's long been a push by a lot of people in Gary, including State Senator Eddie Melton, to turn it into an intermodal facility, because you've got the water there, you've got the Gary Airport there, all the highways are there, the rail lines are there. You know, this could be sort of a place where companies warehouse their stuff and then ship it out all over the country, you know, through online ordering or similar things like that, or rail companies could offload their stuff in Gary instead of going all the way to Chicago and probably save a day or two. So there are a lot of possibilities for Buffington Harbor. I think the hotel will probably just sit there until one of those possibilities comes to fruition.
Yeah. So
at the same time, you know, those there's two boats there too. I mean, these are actual casino boats in the harbor, and they're available for $3 million each if you're looking to buy a boat with 25 years of embedded cigarette smoke.
Was there? We know for sure that they've gotten some hard use out of them, to be sure.
Yeah.
When they aren't closed up, to be sure they're going to. They'd be interesting to see if somebody is really and truly interested in that. They could. They probably get them for quite literally a song, to be sure.
I mean, they were more than $40 million when they were purchased.
Oh, jeez.
And one of them was constructed by Donald Trump, former president of the United States. So there's a historical angle to it.
Let me, if I may, bring up one news story that's out there that people can check out in more detail. And actually, it's come out of the Indiana Attorney General's office. The Attorney General has gotten some assistance from the courts to be able to get a big judgment on a Munster-based debt collector. Can you tell us what that's all about and what kind of settlement they've worked out?
Yeah, this is actually a pretty big deal. There's a company called New Britain Financial. It's owned by a guy named Nelson Macklin that was operating out of an office on Ridge Road in Munster for the past few years. And they were sending, according to the Attorney General, debt collection letters to people all over the country. But the company didn't actually own their debt. So the Attorney General filed a complaint saying that was a deceptive practice under Indiana consumer protection laws. And this company, this New Britain Financial, didn't actually come to court to defend its business practices or contest what the Attorney General alleged it was doing. So a court the other day issued a judgment of $1.4 million against the company. About $400,000 of that will go back to consumers who paid this debt company for debts they potentially didn't owe or that this company didn't own. And the rest will be civil fines paid to the state, assuming this company can be located and, you know, made to pay this money that would be used for further consumer protection activities by the Attorney General.
Well, we can thank the AG's office for being very diligent about that, too. And we thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about these stories that you've had out there in print and online. And we hope to have you back on again soon.
Anytime.
It's Dan Carton. He's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. For the first time today, we have Amy Lavallee, who's a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune, to talk about her stories. Amy, thanks for joining us on the program.
You are welcome. Thanks for having
me. Well, let's take a look first at the two big stories you've had out recently, and one of them involves a matter for the courts. It was a case that involves a former Portage City Clerk Treasurer. Tell us about him, about the charges that landed him in court and the sentencing that he got.
Chris Stidham was originally charged with a level 6 felony of official misconduct. And that happened about 14 months ago. And it involved hiring his then-girlfriend to do bookkeeping for the city of Portage when he was clerk treasurer. And she was paid, you know, on contract. She quit right before they got married, to be clear.
Right.
So, you know, it was his girlfriend. They weren't married, but they were living together. He was helping support her. She was supposed to be providing bookkeeping work and bank reconciliation for the city of Portage. She wasn't doing any of the work. She was working under three different companies. And so he ultimately pled to a level 6 felony of conflict of interest. And he pled guilty in November, I believe. I think he was supposed to do it in September, and Judge Mary DeBoer recused herself because she'd had prior contact with him over another matter and didn't feel comfortable doing it. Not a criminal matter. He's an attorney. He was an attorney, so it had been something else. So the case was moved to Judge Jeffrey Clymer in Superior Court. So he was pleading guilty to a felony count of conflict of interest, and his hope and his attorney's hope was that he would be sentenced as a level A misdemeanor, the highest level of misdemeanor, because having a misdemeanor on his record would allow him to keep his law license. He would still suffer repercussions from the disciplinary board because he would still have been convicted of a crime by pleading guilty. But the hope was that with the misdemeanor, he could still keep that law license. And ultimately, he was sentenced on a level 6 felony.
Mm-hmm.
Because Judge Clymer said that in Mr. Stidham's pre-sentencing investigation with the probation department, he talked about how he had worked with Rachel Glass, now Rachel Stidham, and talked to her about setting her business up into three different companies to lessen the chance that they would get caught in what they were doing. So though his defense attorney had argued that this was, you know, aberrant behavior, this was out of character, the judge's point was he planned this. He planned this to try to avoid detection. And he was, you know, the phrase that the judge uses that he had been scheming, you know, and as the judge said, white-collar crime is still a crime. It's really very sad. Mr. Stidham had worked for the city of Portage, I think in economic development, before he was elected as clerk treasurer. He was a promising young attorney. He had a political career ahead of him. He had run for mayor. He is a Democrat. He'd run for mayor in the primary against Sue Lynch and lost.
Mm-hmm.
Sue Lynch, as you know, is now Portage's mayor. And he really had a very promising life ahead of him. And, you know, as Judge Clymer said in court, you know, there is no joy in this. It just felt terrible.
And I understand, too, that, and you mentioned this in your story, that I'm sure that he probably came up in the sentencing hearing, that Mayor Lynch had to testify or at least speak to the fact that the city of Portage had to spend a lot of money to get some of the economic matters taken care of after all this.
They did, and they also, and I referenced this in the story, and I've mentioned it before, there were forms that Mr. Stidham was supposed to be filing with the IRS, and basically it's a list of everybody who's employed there, and they use it, I think, to determine who's eligible for insurance kind of thing. He wasn't filing any of those forms. So the city had to do that later after he had left office, and there were huge fines from the IRS. So the city was already cash-strapped, and I think the mayor had said $255,000 in IRS fines and almost $30,000 to bring in an outside accounting firm to clean up the bookworking mess. And, I mean, the defense attorneys did point out, you know, those things were not part of the charge, mm-hmm. nor were they part of the restitution to the city and to the State Board of Accounts, which he had to pay back for their special audit
right.
to see what was going on. But it was still just a sign that things weren't taking place as they should have for someone elected to that position.
And as you mentioned in your story, too, about it's another sad chapter in problems financially as well as politically in the city of Portage with people that have been previous city officials. They've ended up being charged and either gone on trial or, in this case, with Mr. Stidham, they've ended up in court for sentencing. And it's just another blotch on the reputation of the city of Portage, isn't it?
It is, as I'm sure people are aware, former Mayor James Snyder is awaiting sentencing in federal court. Though I haven't covered his federal trial, I've obviously followed it and done some of the side stories.
Mm-hmm.
He was convicted in his first trial with defrauding the IRS, which was not connected to city business, to be clear. And then he'd also been charged with steering a towing contract and taking a bribe for garbage trucks. And how he was found not guilty on the towing charge, though his co-defendant, Mr. John Cortina, had pled guilty to that charge. And ultimately, Mr. Snyder was found not guilty on that charge. He was found guilty on the garbage truck bribery allegations, asked for a new trial, received a new trial, and was found guilty another time. He's awaiting sentencing July 1st. On both the IRS count and the one involving the garbage trucks. And I would hope that once this is all done and that's all concluded, because that's been going on for several years, that the city really can move on.
Mm-hmm.
Because the new administration, the mayor and Clerk Treasurer Nina Rivas both took office in January of last year, along with several new city council members. And they're working very hard to try to get things back in order. And I would hope that without these distractions, just even if it's not something they personally have to deal with day by day, the mayor has consistently said, this is just a cloud over the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be nice if they could just kind of move forward from all this.
We're talking with Amy Lavallee, who is a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune, about the story she has had put in print and online out there. And another story, shifting from Portage to Chesterton, involves some protests, peaceful protests, but protests just the same, by students about the removal of rainbow flags. Will you tell us about that story, please?
I started seeing things about this on social media over the weekend, and from what the administration has said in their remarks, and certainly what the families, the parents, and the students have said, to be clear, as I mentioned also in that story, the administration has not said specifically what the items were that have been removed. But the families, the students, and their parents have said that, and the administration has confirmed that there were three teachers at Chesterton Middle School that had rainbow flags in their classrooms to let students who were gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer,
mm-hmm.
know that was, they could feel comfortable talking to the teacher, but they didn't have to be afraid in that classroom. And one of the students I talked to said, you know, her first day of school, she walked in, she had these items up and the magnets and other items, and it really put her at ease because she was concerned and she felt much better seeing these items, like, you know, I'm welcome here. And then they were taken down. I think last Monday, there was a parent who had complained. I've also heard that there were Black Lives Matter posters involved. I've not heard that from the students. I've heard that, you know, sort of third hand, so I haven't been able to confirm that personally, but
yeah.
I have heard those were also involved in the items that had to be taken down. And, you know, there were probably 225 people that gathered at a park near Chesterton Middle School, which is the school where this occurred. On Monday, there was a school board meeting at 6 to talk about a building referendum, or a bond issue, excuse me, $168 million bond issue for building renovations district-wide.
Mm-hmm.
They were not, you know, the issue of the flags was not on the agenda. Initially, the school board was only going to focus the meeting on the building project, but they did ultimately, you know, allow, you know, community members to speak at the end of the meeting. But I have a lot of questions, and some of them are rhetorical. I don't know if I'll ever know the answer, but I don't understand why, if these items had presumably been up in the classroom all year, why now? Like, did someone just suddenly notice there was a rainbow on the wall? And that's very unclear to
yeah.
me. And those are the kinds of details I don't know that we'll ever know. But
well,
if a student is telling me that she went into class and they were there on her first day, and then suddenly 3/4 of the way through the school year, it's like, now I've got to take it all down. I don't really understand what happened.
Well, it sounds like there'll be obviously more stories to come and more angles to the
yeah.
story, to be sure. And
yeah.
we'll look forward to seeing those. And thank you very much, Amy, for spending time going over the stories that you've had out there already.
Thank you.
Amy LaValle is a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Jasper County Jail has turned to innovative technology that keeps sheriff's deputies, staff, and inmates warm in the winter, cool in the summer, and saving thousands of dollars in monthly energy bills. Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick spoke with Pat Williamson and Wendell Culp, who in turn explained how using solar energy is paying big dividends. Here's the conversation.
The solar energy is grabbing the attention of a lot of cities, counties, school districts, and other organizations throughout the state of Indiana and the country. All those places looking for ways to get a handle on energy costs. The Jasper County Jail in Rensselaer, a 120-bed correctional facility, certainly among them. Solar energy could generate 50 to all of the jail's energy needs. And I'm pleased to welcome to the show Jasper County Sheriff Pat Williamson and Jasper County Commissioner's President Kendall Culp. And gentlemen, welcome to the program. Okay.
Thank you.
To tee things up, this has been an ongoing issue for well over a decade, and that's the really serious issues with heating and cooling at the jail. Sheriff, give us an idea of how challenging it was in the winter with blankets, et cetera. How challenging were those issues at the jail?
Well, we weren't able to even adjust our environments inside many of our rooms in the jail, in the office portion, the admin area. Some of the offices were at a rate of, 50 degrees and, wearing good clothing that's thin in the wintertime indoors, it made it difficult to work. Our inmates were given extra blankets and sweatshirts, that type of thing, to keep them warm. We had humidity levels in the summertime that were really out of control, making, our business side of it with papers and so forth very difficult to work.
Yeah. Yeah. Kendall, talk about that cost issue, because obviously the commissioners, now they're looking very closely at that. It had gotten, as you told me off camera here a minute ago, pretty much gotten out of control.
Yes, it was. We were having a hard time even controlling online with our software, the temperatures in the jail, whether it was summer or winter, heat and cold. So it was really a mess, and we were really struggling with how to resolve it.
Yeah, Kendall, from a commissioner's standpoint, what were the things you really looked at when the suggestion came to go solar? Did everybody kind of buy in at that point?
Yeah, it was such a unique idea that we've had heating and cooling issues at the jail since construction, since it was designed. It was faulty. And so we've dealt with high utility bills. And the worst part of it was, even though we were paying high utility bills, there still was not a comfort level within the jail for our employees. And that just wasn't acceptable. And we just tried a myriad of different options and different things that we tried to improve the situation. And so when Train came forward with the thought of maybe we should look at a renewable option, to look at solar. It actually started with a solar option to heat our domestic water needs. And so we started with that. And actually from there, we thought if we're really going to have a big impact, make a big difference as far as lowering our utility costs, then we need to look at powering the whole jail with solar energy. And so that's really how it started. And we were so intrigued with that. We signed on with Trane to lead this project for us. And really, we had instant buy-in from everyone. I mean, we were so excited to have an option that we thought would work compared to everything else we tried. Why we just went forward with it immediately.
Yeah, so 2,300 roughly panel solar array right next to the jail. Been operational since January or late January, I guess. Just had a ribbon cutting this week. Can you talk about savings, what you're seeing at least in these first few months?
Well, we definitely have. Of course, we've had a fairly cold winter those few months. We have seen our utility bills drop, and we've looked and done some projections. We financed this for 15 years, which is a fairly long time to finance that. But we've done that because we believe with our projections we can cash flow this project just through the energy savings we've received.
Wow.
Which, you know, it's not too often you can make a capital investment and cash flow that over time, but we really feel that that's achievable.
Technology used in a variety of ways increasingly. Those two companies involved, Trane Technologies here in Indianapolis and Solential Energy in Carmel. Sheriff Pat Williamson, Jasper County, Kendall Culp, the president of the commissioners, thank you both. Interesting story. We look forward to following up in the months ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Dan Carden with the Times of Northwest Indiana, to Post Tribune freelance reporter Amy LaValle, and with Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick. I hope you'll be back with us on Monday.